Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, June 20th. I'm Lisa Music, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news special, kelp is in big trouble along the north coast with changing ocean conditions and an imbalance of predators and prey. Sarah Reith brings us this half-hour special.
The first North Coast Kelp Fest on the Mendocino Coast just drew to a close with events about aquaculture in Fort Bragg. Kelp Fest was a month-long blitz of events highlighting the ocean conditions that have led to the proliferation of purple urchin and the disappearance of kelp. A trio of movies about kelp even made it into the Mendocino Film Festival this year. In 2013, a warming ocean and a mysterious disease that killed off the Pycnopodia sea star led to an explosion in the population of purple urchin, a shallow water native species that feeds on kelp. The Pycnopodia sea star was the one remaining predator of the purple urchin since the local population of ocean otter was wiped out in the 1800s during the fur trade. For the last 10 years, the urchin have devoured 96% of the kelp along the California coast, destroying the abalone fishery and dealing a significant blow to the red urchin fishery. Dave Rudy is chairman of the California Sea Urchin Commission and a partner in Pacific Rim Seafood in Fort Bragg's North Harbor. On Saturday, he was visiting the urchin ranch down the street and waiting on a shipment of red urchin from Alaska.
The first thing that happened is in 2013, there was the wasting disease of starfish. So for some reason, starfish from Alaska to Baja California died. They just disintegrated. They wasted away. And the Pycnopodia, which is the largest of the starfish, was probably hit the hardest. Something like 99.9% of the starfish died along the coast here of these Pycnopodia. And the Pycnopodia are purple urchin eaters. So that was the first thing that happened. And at the time, there was lots of kelp and everything was thriving, so nobody really noticed that it could have such a big effect. But then when the warm water started in 2014 and 2015, we still didn't really notice a problem. We just noticed the kelp was gone. And then when we had the El Nino in 16-17, then there was this huge recruitment of purple urchins. Every time we have an El Nino in Northern California, the recruitment of sea urchins increases. The California Sea Urchin Commission funds research that has been working on sea urchin settlement for over 25 years now. So we've seen these patterns develop that in the North Coast, in an El Nino, you have high recruitment of sea urchins, all kinds, purples and reds. And it's always been more recruitment of purples than red urchins by a ratio of about 10 to 1. But what happened this time is when these purple urchins recruited in that El Nino, there were no starfish to eat them. So they quickly grew up, and whatever kelp was left, they ate it. And then because the water was warm, anyway, the kelp died because the water was warm, and then all these urchins showed up. They had nothing to eat, so they scoured the bottom. And then when the water got cold again by 2019 or so, the problem was that there were so many urchins, when the kelp settled out, they just ate the baby kelp.
So is there a complete overlap between the red and the purple urchin's habitat, or are there some conditions that one prefers over the other?
There are. Purple urchins tend to be in shallower water, and red urchins tend to be in deeper water, but you do see a combination of all of them. It's just sort of a gradient. So in really shallow water, it might be, let's go back in time before the starfish were killed off. Maybe it was 50-50 in shallow, and you got to deep and it was, 90% red urchins. But now it's in shallow, it's 99% purple urchins, and you go out deep and maybe it's 50-50 on the reds and the purples. You get out in really deep water and there's not very many purples. It's still mostly reds. I'm talking about 80 or 100 foot, something like that.
So what are you expecting with the La Nina year coming up? Are you hopeful that that's going to restore some balance? Is there some scientific findings to support any kind of optimism?
Absolutely. Cold water is always good for kelp. The water temperature is a primary driver in the kelp. If you look back in time, you look at kelp maps, the biggest factor on kelp is water temperature. So that's sort of a given. So again, the problem is with so many purple urchins out there, although the kelp could grow because of the cold water, it may not be able to because there's so many purple urchins ready to eat it.
Now a consortium of local entities has teamed up with scientists from around the region, including Moss Landing Marine Labs and the Hughes Lab at Sonoma State University, to find out if kelp, abalone, and purple urchin can be grown in captivity to restore some balance to the ocean and a livelihood to divers. The idea behind raising the urchin is that if divers can sell the wild-caught animals to the farms, the urchin can be plumped up and sold on the seafood market for uni, the gonad in their shells that's considered a delicacy. In the north harbor of Fort Bragg, which is a major draw for visitors in addition to being a working harbor, the Noyo Center for Marine Science has set up a field station, which includes a small experimental urchin ranch in a shipping container. Richard Millis is the field station manager.
Can you talk about how those urchin came to be in those tanks and what they've been doing since they started their lives in captivity?
Yeah, so we've gotten the urchin for the most part from the intertidal zone. We get them from the barrens, you know, where they're really huge populations, and we bring them in and they're quite empty, you know, hardly any food in them. And we feed them pellets and a mix of the dulse that we're growing, and try to plump them up to see if we can get some viable gonad from them, uni, you know.
How's it going so far?
So far it's pretty good. It's been a little trial and error, you know, getting the system dialed in, and we're getting water brought to us from in the harbor, and so, you know, just adjusting the chemistry to it and trying to get our bacteria cultures and our biological filter established. And but our general rates of mortality are down really low now, and things seem like they're going in a good direction.
How can you tell that an urchin is fat and healthy without cracking it open?
You really can't. You have to do kind of a sampling when you're, you know, what I've noticed is we'll, you know, get a bunch and, you know, take maybe like, say, 3 out of 10 or something and just open them up and, you know, record what they've got in them. Because, I mean, the barrens, they're all in a similar situation. You know, there's thousands of them.
Due to a quirk in their biology, the urchin can go into a dormant state for a fantastically long time, which makes it just about impossible for them to starve to death. And they are not picky eaters.
There was something that I learned just this morning from you is that sometimes they eat each other.
Yeah, you know, I'm not super informed on that, but they do tend to do a little cannibalizing, and we've seen it in our system a little bit. I've seen it in the intertidal. I don't know if it's just certain ones like to eat other ones, or and if it's an acquired taste.
So what do you do with the urchins that grow up here?
It's community stuff, so we've been letting people taste them. You know, we're not going to sell any, as far as I know. You know, it's mostly to educate people that we have something out here that you can eat that is overpopulated. And so it's a restorative seafood product, because if you take it out of the environment, it's helping the environment.
And I guess I'm wondering what the cost is for farming them here. Is it a really cost and energy intensive procedure?
It's an energy intensive somewhat, you know. I mean, pumps and chillers take a lot of, you know, power, but our temperature here is quite low. You know, I mean, it would be more expensive if we were inland and it was trying to keep it cool from 100 degrees. But, you know, we're keeping our water temperature about 58. And so our chillers aren't actually working that hard. And then the pumps, you know, put the water where it needs to go, and gravity takes it all back, you know. And so it's, I'd say the biggest energy consumer, though, is like the cleaning that goes into it, you know, keeping the systems clean. There's algae that grows on stuff. Urchins are quite the prolific poopers, you know, and so it's a constant chore. But, you know, if you could expand this, it could be really viable, you know, where if you had, you know, we have 6 raceways inside, but if somebody had 100 raceways, you know, and were able to buy, you know, these urchin that are empty at a cheap cost, you know, it could be a really viable situation for some entrepreneur.
But figuring out how to feed an animal you're trying to remove from the ecosystem because it's gone through its food source takes finesse or science. For one of the Kelp Fest events on Memorial Day weekend, scientists converged on Big River Beach near the town of Mendocino to talk about how to propagate that nearly missing link.
Hi, my name is Bennett Bugby. I'm a graduate student at Moss Alliance Marine Labs in the phycology lab.
What's phycology?
Phycology is the study of algae. I specify in studying macroscopic or visible algae, mostly kelps.
And you've got a little setup here for growing kelp, and you're telling visitors how you grow kelp in the lab. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, so we would grow kelp in what is called an aquaculture setting, or like a land-based farm. And so we have these tanks filled with seawater that get supplied with seawater. And what we do is we add aeration to the tank, and it creates a turbulent environment, sort of similar to like a washing machine. And it keeps the kelps moving around and mixes the nutrients around. So it's a really nutrient-rich environment, and you can grow a lot of kelp in a small area.
And I think that I have heard your lab come up an awful lot in the hopes that people have for revitalizing the bull kelp here and in other parts of California where we're experiencing urchin barrens. So can you go into some detail about what you're doing to help us out with that?
Yeah, so we've been doing kelp restoration up on the North Coast for like the last 3-4 years. We started in 2021, coming up to Albion. In those first couple years, we were testing out different methods of kelp restoration. So we tested using the sori in like little bags at the bottom and seeding an area. Sori are the reproductive patches bull kelp grows on its blades when it gets to the surface. We developed a method in the lab where we can grow the reproductive material by cutting the nematocysts of the blade or the bull kelp and just tumbling the blades around the tank, and then the blades will grow and eventually produce sori in the lab. And so we can have sori available for an annual species year-round, which makes it really great for restoration because we can be really flexible in what we want to do and when. So yeah, we put the sori down in sori bags, and that will seed an area. We put out what is called green gravel, which is this technique where you can seed kelp onto rocks in the lab and put those rocks out. And we tried a couple other methods, and we learned the urchins really like kelp. So those rocks that we put out, they were able to graze them down, even though urchins were removed to a low density. But those sori bags we put out were really great at facilitating recruitment of kelp around them. And we saw this artifact where we had these lines out underwater to help us navigate between our plots. And the kelp grew on those lines, and they, because bull kelp is buoyant, started lifting the lines off the bottom of the ocean, and the urchins couldn't get to it. And so we figured this like technique of sori bags and growing kelp off the bottom was like a good technique to go forward with it. So last year, 2023, that's the two techniques we used at Albion, and we had really good success. We were able to grow bull kelp from spore to a full reproductive adult in the ocean for the first time on the California coast in a restoration setting, so that's really exciting, with the help of Sonoma State University. And that was during an El Nino year when kelp is supposed to not be, like, happy.
So is this something that is gonna be applicable to large areas?
Yeah, this new technique is aimed at being less diver intensive. So a lot of the experimental stuff we've been doing the last few years, we've been doing scuba diving. But ultimately, we want to come up with a method that's scalable and relatively easy to deploy. And so with these units, the idea is that we can grow the kelp in the lab in that tumble culture, take the kelps and splice them into lines onto these units. And someone who has a boat could take these units and just like throw them off like a trap, like a crab trap, and let it grow.
And would that interfere with other forms of marine life, like otters or seals or, you know, whales and dolphins who could crash into them and get entangled?
No, they're pretty low profile, and that was a concern with some of the permitting agencies, and we made sure to keep these units low profile. They're no more than a meter in size, both width and height. We think it won't be too it won't interfere too much with like the marine life around there, and we actually think it will help facilitate a lot of recruitment of fishes, and we're already seeing that with some of our modules that we put out this year. We've seen juvenile rockfish recruit to the kelp, even the like sub-canopy kelp that we have out there.
And you said you just started doing this last year?
These specific units we just started this year. We've been doing kelp restoration up here since 2021.
Back at the Urchin Ranch, Sarah Grimes, the stranding coordinator for the Noyo Center, was outside using a pair of specialized pliers to help the urchin make their way along the food chain.
What I'm usually up to is responding to deceased marine mammals out there on the beaches. But I also grew up here in the intertidal zone, exploring tide pools, one of my favorite things to do. And recently we've had some really low tides, and I've been going out and picking purple urchins. And I'll actually crack them open right there in the tide pool and look and see how they're doing. And just this last week, so beginning of June, some of the perps that I've been opening up in the intertidal have been pretty plump. So cracking them open and tasting them right there in the surf zone is like the best. So you get a fishing license, go out, do your tide pool etiquette, don't stomp on everything else, don't crunch the urchins, and then crack open a purple urchin. You'll get the salt water wash, fresh ocean water, and then pop up, you know, a piece of the uni into your mouth, and it's like salty, and then it explodes with sweetness. And I think that that's the best way to have a purple urchin.
Where did these urchins come from? Did they come from directly from the tide pool, or are they urchins that were grown at the Urchin Ranch right behind us?
I think these were picked out of the tide pools, just picked by hand, and then put into one of our raceways over there and fed the byproduct, the kombu byproduct, and then plumped up a little bit. So when I open them up, I'm finding some pretty good uni.
So how is that, like, on the spectrum of fat for an urchin?
Yeah, that's plump. That's a pinky-sized finger in there. And if you could see it, you'd see something that looks like a tongue. I would throw it on an arugula salad, squeeze some lemon, and eat it.
And there's five of these little nibbles in each urchin, right? And their mouth parts have five parts. Can you kind of describe their anatomy?
Yeah, so we're really familiar with sea stars, and often they have the five arms, and sea urchins are the same. They've got they're cousins, so they've got that radial symmetry. They're beautiful. If you've seen a sea urchin shell, you can really see that star, and see how they're echinoderms, sea stars, sea cucumbers. Sand dollars and sea urchins are all in the same family.
And what's their mouth is called? Is it an Aristotle's or a Diogenes lantern? It's this really beautiful structure.
Yeah, the Aristotle's lantern, it comes together in a little star as well. It's like five shell parts that come together, and they use that mouth part to cruise around and munch on stuff. And they can like chew plastic, they can chew rock, they can obviously eat a ton of kelp. And they can, they're pretty strong little parts, different from the sea star with that. Sea star kind of puts its stomach out over whatever it's eating, where urchins are just munching away with that little Aristotle's lantern.
Dave Rudy, seafood processor and chair of the California Sea Urchin Commission, is keeping an eye on local developments.
I'm hoping it works so we can harvest the purple urchins and get them out of the environment and help bring the kelp back so we can have our red sea urchin fishery revive and the abalone fishery revive someday.
So is the purple urchin currently a viable food source, or is it still kind of in the experimental phases?
Well, if they're full of uni, It's perfectly marketable. The problem is most of them are completely empty and starving. But if they have uni in them, yes. I mean, I'll buy the purple urchins if they have uni in them.
Is it cost effective to raise them this way? I mean, there's a shipping container with some tanks and a few handfuls of urchins. Is this at this point, is it kind of a cool science experiment, or is it a ranch with some product that you're buying? Are you currently buying it?
At this point, it's a science experiment. It has the potential of, you know, expanding to the point where it could be a viable business. There is a company in Southern California doing this on a commercial level, a company called Urchinomics, and they're buying from the divers in Southern California, working out of Port Hueneme, and they're trying to make this a commercial venture that's hopefully profitable. But it's a, you know, a big investment in equipment and leases and, you know, food for the urchins and paying the divers for the urchins, so... It's still an unknown if it can be viably commercially.
Finding Out is a linchpin of a local initiative in Fort Bragg called the Blue Economy, which seeks to promote economic growth and the ocean's ecosystem. The city and the Sherwood Valley Band of Pomo Indians, the Noyo Harbor District, and the Noyo Center for Marine Science are working with West Business Development Center and Sea Grant California on a number of projects, including the possibility of aquaculture as a serious business venture. For the final Kelp Fest event on Sunday, city staff, volunteers, and a Sea Grant fellow led a tour of the South Harbor. Just outside the Fort Bragg city limits, it boasts 256 slips and is the only safe harbor between Eureka and Bodega Bay. 190 of those are year-round tenants, and they include boats outfitted for commercial and recreational urchin, salmon, and crab fishing. Now there's an effort underway to figure out if aquaculture has a place in one of those slips.
I'm Jamie Miller. I'm with California Sea Grant. I'm the Coastal Mendocino Extension Fellow, and I'm working with the City of Fort Bragg and the Noyo Harbor District on the Noyo Harbor Blue Economy Visioning, Resiliency, and Implementation Plan. And as part of that plan, we're conducting an aquaculture feasibility study, and we're about to go see one of the water quality sensors that we have in the harbor here in Noyo.
And are there any animals in here yet?
There's no animals in here yet. We are waiting for our scientific collections permit, but at the Noyo Center Field Station, we will be putting in Pacific oysters, purple sea urchin, red abalone, and then in terms of seaweed, we'll have bull kelp and dulse.
The sensors and the urchin ranch have both been underway for about 2 months. Miller headed down the dock and stood next to an unassuming piece of PVC with some holes drilled into it at the end of a slip in the mooring basin.
These ones monitor water temperature, salinity, and dissolved oxygen. And we put them as deep as we could down there because we wanted to really understand what the salinity at depth would look like, because that's most likely the salinity range that would be best for the animals that we want to put in the water. It's about 1 meter from the bottom, and then it has a battery up here with a telemetry system. So it's gathering that data every hour, and then through the telemetry system, it uploads it to our software every 4 hours. And then we've made all that data publicly available on our website. So that's noyooceancollective.org. And if you go to the aquaculture feasibility tab, there's a public portal that you can select there, and that's through Lake Tech. I've made some graphs on there, so just really simple ones that show the water quality or the water temperature for all of the sensors, and you can compare and contrast. And then there's a salinity one and a dissolved oxygen one, but they can get very complex. So if you have a request, let me know, and I can build a graph for you and put it on that public portal so you can monitor the water quality yourself and view it, you know, for your own purposes. And we purchased 3 of the 4. So the one that's at Noyo Center, we are working with Lake Tech, and that's so that they can monitor it and maintain it. So that way we make sure we have consistent and reliable data for a year for our study over there. But then we also wanted to make all of this whole process very accessible for the community and to learn together as a community. So we purchased the other 3. So the one that's right here in the mooring basin, and then 2 more that are closer to the mouth of the harbor. And yeah, that's so that we could learn what it takes to monitor the water, upload it to our website, and then also this equipment we're going to give to the Noyo Center once our study is done, so that they can keep monitoring the water and keep using it for future projects. And we wanted to put this one here in the mooring basin because, as Sarah mentioned previously, there's the potential for aquaculture operations in slips like this one. So she referenced the FLUPSI, which is the floating upwelling system, and it's essentially this raft that has an aeration system, and so you can put oysters or urchin inside of them, and that's where they live, that's the surface that they'll live on top of, and it's a structure like this where you can come out and monitor them, and it floats on the surface off the dock. There's some in Humboldt right now, like all over, and we thought we'd want to make sure we have the water quality data here so that if that's something someone wants to do in the future, that they can reference that data for this location. And we also thought that aquaculture in this context would be a great potential supplementary income for fishermen or for other people working in the harbor, because the FLUPSI system is so manageable. And you can like pick the scale that you want it at. So you can have like a smaller operation, or you can have multiple of them and have a larger operation. But you know, in case the weather's bad and you can't go out on the boat, you have another operation going.
So So who all is using this science or could use the science? Is it like businesses or scientists who want to study the environment and the effects of climate change? What do you see as the future of all this data?
I think it's all of the above. I think it could be, yeah, public sector, private sector. In terms of private, it could be for future commercial operations. So anyone who wants to get into the aquaculture industry, and hopefully this is an operation that makes access into it a little easier, so easier entry into the industry. But then there's also a lot of restoration programs and efforts that are going on in the area, and aquaculture is definitely an option to support all of those efforts. So, I mean, I see it as all of the above. And right now our study it's a proof of concept study, so it's very much research-based. But we're going to be gathering that baseline information that can hopefully support all these other projects and make recommendations for the future.
How long are they going to be here?
So our study is for 1 year, and that's going to start at the moment we can put the animals in the water. So we're hoping late June 2024 to late June 2025. And then after that, we need to, you know, synthesize all the data, analyze it, and put that into our report. But we wanted it to be 1 year so that we can monitor it throughout all the seasons, because we want to really understand, too, like with all the fresh water coming into the harbor in the winter, how does that affect things, and how well will the animals do in that type of climate and season?
The seasons are changing, as Dominic Weaver, a recreational fisherman and another one of the guides on the tour of South Harbor, pointed out.
We had 54, 55 degree water out here in March. And by March, it should have been down to 48, 49. So it turned over pretty quickly, and it's only 49 degrees out there right now. But the warm water bubble is sitting about 170 miles offshore right now, where it's 57 degrees again. We've been like 6 to 10 degrees below our normal average this whole spring. With this wind, it's created all this upwelling, and that's what's happening out in the ocean right now. Is the ocean's been rough, but it's got tons and tons of nutrients. That nutrient-rich cold water has pushed up from the deep water canyons, and now it's sitting right offshore out here, and it's just providing all this food for the bait fish and then the fish that eat the bait fish and the sea lions and the seals and everything. So we're in for probably a pretty spectacular summer and fall with the amount of wildlife and fish and things going on out here in the ocean right now because of how much of this upwelling is going on right now.
And not every species starved during the El Nino.
So the last couple years, we've been in this El Nino period for a little while, and the warm water that comes up from the south and in from the west has come in so close to shore that we were getting albacore tuna 6 miles out, which usually they're a pelagic species that you have to go, you know, at least 15, 20 miles out to get to it. But we were getting them at 6 miles out last year. And then we had the big eye tuna that are very popular in like Hawaii and whatnot. We had a big population of them come through the last 2 years in that warm water that's come so close to shore. And then bluefin tuna, which like you've seen the Wicked Tuna Show on TV. It's just like that. They're not quite as big. I mean, those guys are getting ones that are 1,000 pounds, but we had guys out of here getting them close to 300 pounds. Yeah. A little 14-foot aluminum boat. Yeah. So like in October of last year, I was standing on the bluff right there at Todd Point, right at the south end of the harbor mouth, and I could see schools of bluefin tuna jumping out of the water eating bait from shore with no binoculars. Wow. And they were only in 250, 300 feet of water. Wow. So it has been very incredible, that warm water and what comes with that warm water. We've had marlin caught out of here in the last couple years. There's been a couple Dorado, a couple of yellowtail, all fish that you usually would see in Southern California or Mexico, you're getting them up here now too. And that is a direct reflection of climate change. There's always been, you know, the outliers that would show up. You might, you know, have somebody get one or every 5 years or 10 years, but there was like 7 marlin caught out of here in the last 2 years. That is an indicator that something is changing out there.
With the data from the sensors and the permit to start raising seafood for the next step of the study, Miller hopes that scientists and aspiring aquaculturists on the Mendocino coast will have a few more options for an uncertain future.
Hopefully in the next 2 weeks we will get that permit. We're just waiting for approval, and the animals are ready to go, so we can put them in the water as soon as we get it.
Reporting for KMUD News, I'm Sarah Reith.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening, and thanks to our reporter, Sarah Reith. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Musick.